Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to have a visit with a woman of exceptional courage and clarity about the various challenges that we're facing, this country we love, foreign and domestic. She writes brilliantly about all these topics as a columnist for, as well as the online commentary editor of the Washington Times. She is an accomplished author in addition to a very, very impressive essayist with a number of books, including most recently Lockdown, The Socialist Plan to Take Away Your Freedom is its subtitle. And more to the point, I think, at the moment, socialists don't sleep. Christians must rise or America will fall. Very, very profoundly important topic, especially on the eve of this midterm election. Her name is Cheryl Chumley, and she has become one of our really valued resources for this program. And we're always delighted to welcome her back to Securing America. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us.
Frank, it's great to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. Let me say thank you for all that you're doing, Cheryl, especially at a moment such as this, a time such as this, I think, as the Bible puts it. Let me start with a shared concern we have about what has just gone down in Brazil. And what it suggests is not only a consequence of, as I said in the commentary, at best, the, you know, malign neglect by the Biden administration, and worse, I think, the active connivance of that administration with basically a communist, Lula da Silva, who is now, I guess, going to become the next president of this country, essentially enabling the communists to run the table from the Arctic to the Antarctic in our hemisphere. Give us a sense of how this has come to pass, America's complicity in it under this administration, and the implications.
Yeah, if you look at what Joe Biden said over the recent Brazil elections, he reached out to the new communist in charge and welcomed him and pledged partnership with him. He basically committed America to working together with this new regime. And I find that astonishing that a country like America, free as we are supposed to be, would reach out with such an embrace for a country that now seems to be moving full-blown communist. And it wasn't that long ago where America would not just shun a country like that, but outright condemn a change in leadership that way. And this administration has actively sought to oppose Bolsonaro simply because he was along the vein of leadership that Donald Trump brought to America.
And unfortunately, this is not the only example of that kind of willingness to collaborate with, work with, and otherwise aid and abet communists. I think we've seen it in Peru, in Chile, in Colombia, and Mexico, and other parts of, our hemisphere, which is now pretty much chock-a-block with people of the hard left, certainly every major nation now under their thrall, including our own, as things stand now. And Cheryl, again, just to the question of, you follow very closely and lucid the threat that the Chinese Communist Party represents, the idea that it will benefit massively from this sort of strategic, fundamental transformation is what Barack Obama used to call it, is particularly worrying from a geostrategic perspective, as well as economic and in other ways, no?
China is the elephant in the room here. And I think that over the years, there have been some Republicans who have mistakenly assumed that China wanted to go more free market and were willing to get in bed, corporate speaking, in terms of doing business with China and opening up that country to more free market influences, thinking that once the free market was embedded in China, that China would be the one that changed. But what we're finding out is that's not true. China is communist, and the communists will go for the long term. They have long term goals to become the number one leader in America, in the world, and unseat America from that platform. And I find most concerning their Belt and Road Initiative, which is rapidly progressing and which we don't do enough about talking about and warning in America. And secondly, I find most alarming the cultural influence that has taken root in America, where our younger generations are actually being taught not only to hate the free market capitalistic system, but to embrace the type of policies that China brings, the type of culture that China brings. And this bodes very darkly for America's future in terms of individual liberties coming from God, not government.
Amen. Well, you've made this point brilliantly in several of your books, and I just can't commend you enough for it, because I think that at the end of the day, if we really do depart from those fundamentals baked into our Constitution, we will lose the country for sure. So this makes your point about Christians rising up in this moment, especially in this election cycle, so really incalculably important. Let me just ask you, one of the facets of this that I think underscores another point that I know you've been making assiduously, and rightly so, is that if these countries go the way that communists always take them, which is down the tubes, economically especially, we are assuredly going to see, when combined with the loss of freedom and opportunity, especially, a further out-migration from still more nations in Latin America, which will mean still more illegal immigration into our own country. And talk a little bit about what has already happened to us as a result of the Biden administration's destruction of our border, and what that further wave, Michael Yon calls it the human osmotic force that will be felt here, might mean for our country as well.
If we don't have borders, we don't have a country. I mean, it's as simple as that. And America is different from all other nations in the world because we have that concept of American exceptionalism that is called God-given rights. No other nation has that. Every other nation in the world gets their rights for the individual based on what government allows them to have. And so we need, as a nation, to remain separate and distinct in that. And what the Joe Biden administration has done with alarming speed, allow all these people from countries that do not understand that concept of government being subservient to the people and the people getting their rights from God. And what happens is now you have majorities coming into America that will be the next batch of Democrat voters, which is to say communist type voters, because they're coming from nations where they are conditioned to believe that their government is supposed to provide from cradle to grave. And it will soon enough be in this country that it won't matter how many patriotic, limited government loving Americans go to the polls to vote for strong conservative voices. We will be overwhelmed by the masses who have been brought into this nation.
Hold that thought, Cheryl. We'll be right back with more with Cheryl Chumley of The Washington Times right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro made a brief statement in which he did not concede to his opponent in Sunday's runoff election, Lula da Silva. Afterwards, however, his chief of staff stated that a transition is now underway. If so, every major country in the Western Hemisphere from the Arctic to Antarctica is now or soon will be in the hands of explicitly communist regimes or like-minded ideologues. That's dangerous for freedom in general and America in particular. To be sure, this fundamental transformation has been a long time coming, but it has accelerated dramatically thanks to the Biden administration's malign neglect, if not its active encouragement. Especially the communist victories on its watch in Peru, Chile, Colombia, and now Brazil will imperil U.S. economic interests, assure increased illegal immigration here, and cement China's colonial domination of our hemisphere. God help us. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with the wonderful opinion editor, the online portion of the Washington Times, Cheryl Chumley. She is an author as well as an essayist, and one of the clearest-eyed individuals I know in journalism today. And it's always a delight to have a chance to visit with her. And Cheryl, we've been talking about a succession of challenges that we're facing. One of the others that relates to the foregoing is the fundamental transformation of America, as Barack Obama has described it, that is continuing apace under his former vice president, now president, Joe Biden. And I think you've been properly concerned about, as have I, this whole COVID pandemic response and the extent to which it has been infusing into our country, specifically under the so-called China model of pandemic responses, the lockdowns, the mask mandates, the vaccines that haven't been adequately tested, the enforcement of vaccine mandates, no less, with passports and so on. A sort of communist style takedown of our most fundamental freedoms, as well as, sort of the constitution that guarantees them. Give us a sense of how you see that now and how far advanced it has become.
That's a really good question. And that's why I indeed wrote the book Lockdown, because too many Americans, I believe, are trusting in the government that told us we are back at pre-pandemic normalcies and things are back to normal. Well, I see it as we are in a lull right now, because if you look at what happened for 2+ years of the coronavirus, Americans willingly ceded so many of their individual liberties based on hysterical predictions from the government that came out of the mouths of Anthony Fauci, Bill Gates, and people who were just fabricating data. And so we still have in this country a problem with people driving around in their cars by themselves wearing face masks and believing that that's protecting them. And we also have an onslaught of government sources telling us that we need to vaccinate our children as young as 6 months to save them from the coronavirus, even at the same time they're admitting that the coronavirus shots don't stop the spread of the virus or prevent you from getting the virus. So my assessment of where things are right now is we are not at pre-pandemic norms with our individual liberties in our hands. We are on the edge of a cliff waiting for the government to announce the next pandemic or the next health crisis where we all have to listen to what our government tells us and lock down again.
Yeah. Especially if the administration has its way and the World Health Organization is given increased powers at the expense of our sovereignty, to not only declare what constitutes what they call a public health emergency of international concern, which is broader than just pandemics, and can then direct what needs to be done, what not only needs to be done, what must be done by heretofore sovereign states like ours. Again, this is the kind of thing that I think kind of makes your head explode if you put it all into the context of a larger agenda that is indeed aimed at weakening our country and more, I think, inexorably strengthening our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party, and advantaging it in its efforts to supplant us and become the world's dominant power. No?
And the agenda is there in writing. One need only go to weforum.org to see how the World Economic Forum plans to segue from the coronavirus lockdowns into climate change, or do what I did and pick up a copy of Bill Gates's latest book on how to prevent the next pandemic. The title alone is filled with hubris. He can't, as an individual, prevent that from happening. But it talks about the need to develop this rapid reacts force of scientists to respond to any area of the world where a virus crops up, and then work with local governments in how to so-called defeat that virus, which is code for lockdown. So it's not just a conspiracy theory. Maybe this will happen. Do some reading, and this agenda is already in the works.
Yeah. Andy McCarthy told me years ago that when he was an assistant U.S. attorney in Rudy Giuliani's Southern District of New York's office, that they had a working adage, which was that every conspiracy begins with a conspiracy theory. What you're describing is basically the Gates theory of what that conspiracy should look like. And unfortunately, it's got a lot of company, as you say. It's the World Economic Forum. It's the government and supranational government agencies that they've been infusing with all of this, at the yes. UN and World Health Organization and so on. And then not least, again, the CCP itself. And I guess what I'm particularly interested in is, Cheryl, as you look at this election, which is now less than a week away, there's an opportunity for a course correction, at least in terms of having people in Congress who ostensibly don't want to see this country fundamentally transformed in the ways we've just been discussing. What are the prospects, do you think, that will in fact not only be electorally the upshot of this, but that will be what comes of a new Republican-controlled Congress? House seems reasonably certain, maybe the Senate right. as well.
Well, I predict a red wave, but I also say that with this warning that it's not enough anymore in American history to rely on Republicans winning majorities. We've moved past that. There are forces beyond America's borders that are actively putting in place systems that sort of negate our electoral process, because they will turn our free market, for instance, against us and weaponize the free market and corporate entities against American citizens. And I speak to the ESG agenda and so forth, woke corporations. So it won't matter who's in
office. Environment, social, governance.
Exactly. Agenda, yeah. So, yes, I think Republicans are going to take back both the House and Senate, and that will put a pause on some of the far left agenda steamrolling through the White House. But if we think at this point in time that's enough, we need to wake up. The answer for this country is to recapture and reclaim the concept of God-given rights. That is the ultimate battle here.
Right. And you've been so, as I say, clear-eyed about not only the virtues associated with that model, but also the dangers of the alternative of collectivism, as I think you put it. And it comes under different brands. I'm for calling it communism,
right?
As you know, Marxism, whatever. But whether you call it that or liberalism or progressivism or some other euphemism, the bottom line is it devalues the individual and it elevates the power of the state and imputes to it the determination of your freedoms, not Almighty God. And that's a very, very ominous trend, needless to say. I hope this will be a corrective, both of the kind you've described, but Cheryl, it seems to me it's got to be more than just having Republicans. Those Republicans have to stand for things. They have to be committed to the sorts of changes. And clearly some of those candidates have been very explicit about this kind of, course correction. Some not so much, including among the leadership, I fear. So we'll be watching it closely. We'll be reading carefully your assessments at the Washington Times, and we appreciate the work that you do there tremendously and look forward to our next visit, hopefully very soon. Thanks to all of you for being with us for this particularly important conversation.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. We're going to turn now to developments in Israel of great interest, I think, to the United States. And to talk about them, I'm very pleased to have with us Itamar Marcus. He is the president and the founder of a wonderful organization in the Jewish state called Palestinian Media Watch. It does surpassingly important work, truth-telling, about the nature of the Palestinian, authority, the so-called leadership of the Palestinian community, and what it portends for the security of Israel and its people, but also the implications for us as well, especially at a time when the Biden administration is supporting the Palestinian leadership in a number of ways that are very much, I believe, contrary to both our interests and that of our allies in Israel. But before we get to all of that with Itamar Marcus, I do want to talk about developments yesterday in his homeland, specifically, apparently, the re-election of Benjamin Netanyahu as prime minister with, at long last, a narrow but nonetheless a majority in the Knesset. Have I got that right, Itamar? First of all, welcome back, but tell us what's the lay of the land as you see it.
Well, the overwhelming majority of the votes have been counted, and Netanyahu has a majority. There are still about 500,000 votes of soldiers and people who are in hospitals that aren't going to be counted until tomorrow. So that could actually change how large his majority is. So it could be anywhere probably from a 4-seat majority in the parliament to possibly a 10-seat majority in the parliament, depending on which small left-wing parties may not cross the threshold and lose all their 4 seats. Should the army vote turn out to be a right-wing vote, a vote for Likud, a vote for the right-wing parties, then the Meretz party, which is actually right at the verge now, could actually disappear, and then those 4 seats disappear, and then the majority of the right wing jumps up even higher.
There is also a question, as I understand it, as to whether one of the Arab parties, makes the threshold. How does that look at the moment?
Correct. So that party right now, with just about 100% counted today, is not passing the threshold. So it's expected that when you add the army vote, it's unlikely that it will pass the threshold.
Okay. So this is the context, Itamar, for our conversation with you about policies, both of the Israeli government and of the U.S. government. We are, of course, on the cusp of major elections of our own, which might change the complexion of the Congress in particular, which has to this point supported the Biden administration in sort of nurturing, once again, Palestinian ambitions in ways that seem to me, and I think you've been documenting, are translating into more and more aggressive behavior towards Israel. In fact, well, jihadist behavior at that.
No doubt.
Talk a little bit about what you think Netanyahu restored government would do vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And then we'll talk about what the United States government should do going forward.
Yes. Well, Netanyahu has been the prime minister, I think it's 12 years now, except for this past year and a half. And during that period, the United States has had different presidents, Republicans as well as Democrats. When Trump was president, he definitely understood Israel's challenges with Palestinian terror. He definitely understood the Palestinian hatred. There was a lot of PMW, Palestinian Media Watch material, that was given by Netanyahu to President Trump, which made him realize that Mahmoud Abbas was lying to him. He wasn't educating for peace. And that set in motion a partnership between the United States and Israel, which led to the to bringing in so many of the Gulf states into peace treaties with Israel, and a real broad peace process known as the Abraham Accords. So that was fantastic. So when the American and Israeli leaders are see eye to eye, there's tremendous potential to actually bring peace and to expand peace in the region. In the Obama period, there was a policy of condemning Israel, of pressuring Israel, of seeing Israel as the problem, of agreeing to a UN vote which declared Israeli building in Jerusalem, etc., as illegal settlements, which, of course, by international law, it's not true. And this United States supported. So, and that did not help peace at all. It didn't help peace at all. So,
to the contrary, it actually, again, inspired and inflamed Palestinian aggression. No,
that's right. And now we've had a year and a half under the Biden administration, and there has been, of course, less seeing eye to eye with Israel. And one of the things that we've had is more Israelis and Palestinians killed this year than in many, many years. There's been a massive increase in Palestinian terror. Israel has had to go in and root out the terror, and more Palestinians are being killed as well. So what's happening is when the United States understands Israel's predicament vis-a-vis the Palestinians, understand how they, the Palestinians, leadership is not promoting peace, is promoting terror, they put pressure on the Palestinian Authority, terror drops, and it's beneficial for everyone.
Itamar, when you look at a Netanyahu restoration, if I can use that expression, and thank God for it. I pray that it will be a real solid majority, not just a narrow one, but at least it's a working majority and that is such a, you know, respite from the craziness that Israel has been subjected to for the past 4 years, to say nothing of the interim government, which was a mess in Israel as well. What do you anticipate will be Bibi Netanyahu's posture vis-a-vis the Palestinians and the terror that, as you say, they have been mounting increasingly of late?
Well, there, I'm sure that Netanyahu is going to give the army a free hand. The truth is that this government also more or less gave the army a free hand. The problem was that when the Palestinians see a weakness in Israeli leadership, then they use terror to put pressure on Israel. They've referred to this many times as the cycle of violence. What's the cycle? Terror, terror, terror on Israel. Israelis get fed up with terror. And then the Palestinians say, okay, so compromise, give us some concession in exchange. And I think that's what the Palestinian Authority was working for. Now, they wanted terror on Israel to maybe, with a left-wing government that was in place now, that would eventually say, okay, we will do X, Y, Z if you stop the terror. So that was what they were shooting for. And I think that's all going to be history now. I think the Israeli army will put down this terror wave. And without seeing any political benefit to terror, I think the terror will stop.
And without seeing there's a government in Israel that will be receptive or accommodating of their demands for concessions. In part, though, I am sure that that will be influenced by Bibi's relationship with Joe Biden and the U.S. government more generally. Presumably, we will continue to see, as you said about the Obama team, they were terrible on all of these issues. They're mostly the same people who are now in the Biden administration, of course, and terrible still. This brings us to the question of whether or not, if there is, in fact, a conservative Republican majority in the House, presumably, and possibly even in the United States Senate, whether that will give Benjamin Netanyahu essentially a buffer against the kind of pressure that we might otherwise expect Biden's team will be trying to mount for Bibi's government to be more or less accommodating of this Palestinian agenda as well. Can you give us any guidance on how that looks from Israel? And more to the point, what we should be doing instead of underwriting and otherwise emboldening the Palestinians in midst of such very, very dangerous behavior?
I think historically, what I have found is that the American administrations that were anti-Israel ignored as much as they could the Congress and Senates who were pro-Israel. Because even when there have been Democratic majorities, there have been a majority of congressmen and senators who are pro-Israel for very many years, maybe a little bit less now, but historically The Democrats also supported Israel. I'll give you an example. A number of years ago, long before the Taylor Force Act, we presented the information to Congress, Palestinian Media Watch, on the Palestinian Authority paying salaries to terrorists. Congress, during the period of Obama, passed a law that the amount that the Palestinians were paying on salaries to terrorists and to families of martyrs would have to be deducted from every year's aid. Obama even signed it into law, but then he ignored it. He gave them he allocated $300 million a year and he just gave it to them, ignoring the fact that they were spending almost that same amount on salaries to terrorists. So here you had something very interesting. Congress was on Israel's side, but the government did what they wanted to anyway.
Yeah. Well, this will be hopefully a Congress that is going to be on Israel's side and compel the government to do the sorts of things that the statutes require. We'll be watching this closely. With your help, Itamar Marcus, thank you for your time today. Congratulations on this really important development in Israel. And God bless you and your country. And we'll be talking soon. Next up, we'll speak with Reggie Littlejohn of Women's Rights Without Frontiers right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. We're back, and I'm always delighted to be able to say we're joined by Reggie Littlejohn. She is the founder and president of a wonderful organization entitled Women's Rights Without Frontiers. She is an attorney by training, a highly skilled litigator at that, but she has brought her intellect and her organizational skills to bear on behalf particularly of women who are being severely oppressed in places like communist China, where as a result of the state's efforts to control population growth, their most fundamental rights and, you know, dignity for that matter, are being terribly and with unbelievably profound consequences, not just for them, but for their society, impacted. She has been working specifically to counter the one-child policy, as it's been called, which has given rise, among other things, to, by some estimates, 40 million military-age men for whom there are no women. That's a lot of cannon fodder if, as I fear, Xi Jinping, the dictator of communist China, seeks to engage in external aggression, in part at least to alleviate some of the domestic challenges he's now facing, economic and political. Reggie, it is always good to have you with us. There's a lot to talk about in your battle space, but let's do a little bit of an update on both that one-child policy that's now been changed to a two-child policy, and I guess now a three-child policy, but what its legacy is and its implications for the rest of us. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. So, as you know, the Chinese Communist Party recently had its 20th Party Congress, and we did that great event crashing the CCP Party Congress. One of the things that I was really looking for in Xi Jinping's speech was what if he's going to end coercive population control in China, and he absolutely did not promise that at all. He said he was going to encourage births, which is different from ending what right now he has, which is under the three-child policy, every married couple is allowed to have three children, which gives them the legal right to forcibly abort unmarried women and fourth children. And the State Department and also the State Department recently came out with a report saying that, you know, forced abortion is continuing in China, especially among the Uyghur people. So I am calling upon Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party and also all coercive population control, because the problem that they have with the population in China is not that they have too many people. It's that they have too many old people, too few young people to support the population, and too few women. So that, as you mentioned, There are about 40 million males in China, many of whom are military age, that are that will never have wives because their future wives were aborted before they were born, just because they were girls.
Unless perhaps they go get foreign wives through military adventurism. But Reggie, to this point, one of the things that you've taught me about, which is such an indictment of the Chinese Communist Party, is both the incredibly intrusive way in which they have enforced these population control policies and the death toll that those policies have accrued. You know, we talk, those of us who are critical of China, of course, and you as a member of our committee on the present danger of China are among the most, you know, I think articulate in that criticism, about the 100 million people that Stalin's counterpart, Mao, and his successors have murdered over the years of this misrule by the Chinese Communist Party. That's a fraction.
That's right.
Of the actual death toll. Give us your estimates of what has been the cost of this population control policy.
Well, people talk about the 100 million people that were murdered by Mao or Stalin or various other communist dictators. But the Chinese Communist Party about 10 years ago boasted that they had prevented 400 million lives through the one-child policy. And most of those were prevented through forced abortion, then also forced sterilization, and even infanticide. So after the baby was born, they would throw it in a bucket and drown it. That statistic is quite old. There have been a lot of forced abortions since then, and I would estimate that the death toll is more like 500 million, half a billion people prevented through the one-child policy. And then another thing that happens in China is the sex-selective abortion of baby girls. This is not done by the government. This is done because of son preference in the families. And we are the only organization in the world that has a network on the ground inside of rural China saving baby girls. So what we do is we have these field workers that find out about a woman who either is pregnant with a baby girl or who has given birth to one and who is being pressured to abandon her. Or even under COVID, you know, with the lockdowns, these farming families are in desperate straits financially, and they think about the unthinkable, which is to give away their baby girl as an extra mouth to feed. And we encourage them and we give them a monthly stipend of $25, which is a lot of money in the Chinese countryside, to keep those families together. And we have saved over 300 baby girls at this point through that program.
Oh, bless you. Wonderful. Well, again, the work that you do in this regard in China and elsewhere around the world, to be sure, is so important, Reggie. And again, I think especially to the extent that it's putting a Klieg light on the nature of this Chinese Communist Party, that it has these, I think you've coined the phrase womb police, that they use to monitor and enforce their various requirements, humiliating and obviously devastating to families, especially if they detect that somebody has violated their restrictions and they punish them terribly. We're going to have to take a very brief break, Reggie Littlejohn, and I want to come back to you and talk about another focus of your efforts. As the co-chairman with me, I'm proud to say, of our Stop Vaccine Passports Task Force, a partnership between your organization, Women's Rights Without Frontiers, and our committee on the present danger, China. It's been doing incredibly important work. We're going to talk a bit more about it and what we have in mind next in terms of that agenda. Stay tuned for more with Reggie Littlejohn right after this. We're back we're visiting with Reggie Littlejohn, a heroic figure in the human rights community, an advocate for women's rights in particular as part of her mandate at Women's Rights Without Frontiers, but a champion of all of us, really, especially in the face of efforts that are being made to subject us to domestic forms of repression, not just those that we see elsewhere around the world. Specifically, Reggie has been a leader of a very important initiative. We call it the Stop Vaccine Passports Task Force, a project of her organization, Women's Rights Without Frontiers, and our Committee on the Present Danger China. I'm proud to be her co-pilot in that effort. It has been doing some incredibly important work, especially in the form of a series of webinars that have been exposing what's been going on with respect to these vaccines and the efforts to mandate their use and to enforce the mandates with something that, well, as she puts it, is a conduit for an introductory drug, if you will, for, well, the digital gulag in America. So Reggie, walk us through a bit of that, if you would, the social credit score system and how it's been insinuated here as part of the China model or themes that we talk a lot about here, but I'm always interested in your perspective.
Well, Frank, there's something that recently came up that is of great concern, which is that the CDC has recently recommended COVID-19 vaccines for kids as young as 6 months old. So first of all, this is completely unnecessary. Little kids have no, they're not at risk for serious COVID. They just basically get through it with sniffles. That's number one. And number two, there are serious adverse events that can happen, and kids are getting injured. So when the risk benefit analysis, it just doesn't work out. This should not have happened. And the reason I think that it did happen was so that the COVID vaccine could be on the childhood vaccination schedule, which will mean that the manufacturers are completely immune from liability for injuries or death from childhood all the way through adulthood. That's why I think they're pushing us down there. And the other reason is what you mentioned, which is that if this is on the childhood vaccination schedule, that gives them the excuse to monitor who has taken it and who hasn't, which gives rise to the vaccine passport or the smart health card. So these, as you say, could give rise to the China social credit system. It's the same, it utilizes the same platform. And what that would do is bring totalitarianism, similar to what they have in China, to the United States.
Yeah. So we were just talking in the previous block about what that totalitarianism looks like, how it has been translated into horrific repression of the Chinese people, women and others, of course. And the idea that we would invite it or enable it to be instituted in this country is simply mind-boggling. But just on this question of vaccinating children, especially when there's very little upside, if any, and a tremendous downside. One of our recent webinars, Reggie, we had a powerful testimony by a woman whose daughter at the time, I think, was 12 or so, volunteered to be a guinea pig, basically, in the experiments that were being done pre-introduction of this vaccine. I think it was the Pfizer vaccine, if I'm not mistaken. And she was simply devastated with all kinds of adverse events, as you call them, health crises, really. So the idea that we would invite this, and let alone impose it, on still more children with that background and doing it effectively as part of this sort of China model leading to the gulag is just mind-boggling to me. So thank you for the leadership that you've been exhibiting on this. Tell us a little bit about the Align Act campaign that we've created to try to give people a vehicle for expressing their opposition to this initiative.
Okay, so the CDC has recommended that the COVID-19 be on the childhood vaccination schedule. It's the states that either take up that recommendation or do not take it up. And most states will just take the CDC recommendations and just follow them as being the standard of care. So we need, people need
which,
to-
Which would mean, just to be clear, that if you want your child educated in a public school, and I guess private schools, at least to some extent as well, you have to give them the jab along with other vaccinations. Is that right?
If your state adopts that CDC,
yes.
And there are certain states who've said they will not adopt it. Florida has, for example, said that they're not going to do it. Other states like California have said they are going to do it. So it's up to people to let their state legislators know, let their governors know they do not want this. So the way you can do that is to go on stopvaxpassports.org. That's stopvaxpassports.org. Click on Take Action, and there will be a something, the platform is called Align Act. You can put your name and sign up and send an email to all of your legislators that are going to be making the decision about this. And I would suggest doing it immediately because they need to know this should be a campaign issue. This should be an issue that's coming
Absolutely.
Up before the election. And they, and so that's the way to raise the visibility of this issue before the election and find out where your legislator or potential legislator stands on this issue.
Make it a voting issue, for heaven's sakes, because it could well affect directly the life of your child or perhaps your grandchild, and, you know, our society more generally, obviously, if this is allowed to stand. Reggie, we have other programs coming up. I want to encourage people to watch this space at stopvaxpassports.org, particularly more. We've got in the works a very important webinar about this digital gulag business. And I want to just again thank you for the extraordinary quality of your leadership, as well as the extent to which you relentlessly bring it to bear for the benefit of our people and country. God bless you, my dear. I want to thank the rest of you for being with us for this edition of Securing America, and thank you for taking aboard what I hope will help you help us protect the country we love. And then I ask you to go forth and multiply.